From the Carson Sestouli Memorial Studios in Minneapolis, Minnesota, that is Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass. I am David Temple, and this is Fangraphs Audio. The discerning listener will notice that I am not usual host slash America's burden, Carson Sestouli. Sestouli is not dead, but he is away on vacation this week, so I will be performing at least some of his audio duties during that time. Who is David Temple, you may ask? A perfectly valid question. I am a part-time contributor to Fangraphs.com, the managing editor of its sister technology site, TechGraphs.com, and I host the infrequently updated Stealing Home podcast on the Hardball Times network of podcasts. But this episode is not about me. It is about my guest for this edition of Fangraphs Audio, Dave Cameron. Cameron is, of course, the managing editor of Fangraphs, and he will be performing his weekly duty of analyzing all baseball. The non-waiver trade deadline has officially passed, and so I asked Dr. Cameron his thoughts on the slew of trades that occurred leading up to said deadline. Who do we talk about? We talk about Cole Hamels, we talk about David Price, we talk about Carlos Gomez and Yoenis Cespedes and all the moves that the Dodgers made. The Yankees and Padres are also mentioned, and we discuss if there are any deals coming now that the waiver deadline has passed. It's Fangraphs managing editor Dave Cameron. I'm your host, David Temple. It's Fangraphs Audio, and it's coming right now. We'll just kick right into it. So the non-waiver trade deadline has passed. Passed on Friday at, I think, 4 Eastern or something like that, 3 Eastern.
And apparently we traded Carson Sestouli away.
He was part of the, he was one of the deals. We still don't know who we're getting back in the deal, but
anyone will be an upgrade.
Exactly. That's exactly what I was going to say. So a few big moves happened. There was one that had a lot of players involved, certainly, but I think probably, well, there's two big trades for starting pitchers that happened. I guess we'll start with the Cole Hamels one. That probably has less impact, you know, in this season, perhaps, although the Rangers say that maybe it might have more impact than is real. But Cole Hamels and Jake Diekman go to the Rangers for a package of six prospects. So the Rangers have Cole Hamels. The Phillies finally deal him. Cole Hamels has been rumored very often to be, you know, on the trading block. Do you think this is one of the better deals that the Phillies could have gotten for him?
So this is a tricky one to answer. Obviously, we've been writing about Cole Hamels' trade value for the better part of a year, and in ways that Phillies fans were not very happy with. Right. It seems like there's been an ongoing fight between Phillies fans and Fangraphs for the last 12 months, as, you know, the rumors came out that they wanted, you know, Corey Seager and Jock Peterson and Julio Reyes or Mookie Betts and more, and, you know, like they really seem to put a premium value on Hamels because of his multiple years of team control, thinking that he was going to return back, you know, one of the elite young players in baseball. And I think our position has generally been that that's not going to happen, that, you know, Hamels is a good pitcher, but, you know, his contract's not that cheap, and teams just don't trade away those kinds of players anymore. And so, you know, for the last year or so, it's been, I would say, a contentious relationship between Philadelphia fans and the site. And so, you know, now that we've actually seen the deal go down, I will say that I think this is about what the Phillies should have gotten. And I think this is in line with what we've been saying that they would get all along, is, you know, a good package of prospects and the right kind of return for the Phillies, most likely. But they didn't get the kinds of guys they were asking for, even after picking up $45 million in additional cash. Like you mentioned, it was they got six players back. Only five of them have real value. Well, four even. One of them's a pretty marginal prospect. But Matt Harrison was the sixth guy in that deal. Right. He was basically a $35 million offset in that the Phillies agreed to take the rest of his deal from the Rangers in order to essentially pay down more of Hamels' deal in order to get a better prospect return back. So when you look at it, you can say, okay, well, the Phillies got five prospects for Cole Hamels. They did really well, which I think is kind of the public narrative. But I think realistically, they probably got three prospects for Cole Hamels, one very low-level guy for Jake Diekman, who's, you know, a reliever, throws 98 from the left side, has some value at least, and then probably one prospect for taking on Harrison's deal, plus kicking in, you know, $10 million in cash. So I think realistically, the Phillies got about what we said they were going to get, and I think that, you know, this kind of shows that the market valued Cole Hamels as a good pitcher on a good contract, but not one of the most valuable trade chips in baseball like the Phillies assumed.
And from the Texas side, they get Cole Hamels for the remainder of this year and also next year. Am I correct in that?
Well, they get him for 3 more years. Actually.
3 more years. So this year and then 2 more. Okay.
Yeah. Well, no, 3 more years after this. And there's actually an option for a fourth. So that was one of the reasons why the Phillies thought he was such a marketable chip. Is this is not a short-term piece. This is a guy who's under contract through 2018 with an option for 2019.
Right, right. Okay. I must have I'm misremembering that. So they are currently how many games back? 9 games back or so of the lead of the AL West. So you got to think that this is, I mean, is it a move even for as close to next year? I mean, obviously, you know, in 3 years, Cole Hamels isn't going to be who he is now. Is this kind of a move for 2016? I mean, they still have some pretty valuable players, even though they are in a tough division.
Yeah, I mean, I think from the Rangers' perspective, they've been trying to get Hamels for a while, and I think they looked at it and said, look, you know, a lot of the contenders, or basically all of the contenders, are balking at the Phillies' asking price because the contenders this year were mostly just interested in upgrading this year or not taking on a significant salary for the future. The one team who made kind of a win-now move that also has some long-term impact is the Dodgers, who got Alex Wood, who gives them a starting pitcher, you know, under control for the same 4 years as Hamels is. But Alex Wood makes the league minimum and is going to have 3 arbitration years where he's going to make hardly any money at all. And so the Dodgers decided to go that direction instead of ponying up for Hamels' $23 million a year salary and giving up talent. So I think the Rangers looked at it and said, look, we have a chance to be okay next year if Yu Darvish comes back and gives us, you know, 2/3 of a season or even half of a season, kind of pulls the Jose Fernandez and comes back and gives us, you know, a strong pitcher down the stretch. So if we can get one more good pitcher at the front of our rotation and we get a bounce back year from Adrian Beltre and we work Joey Gallo into the outfield, you know, I think they're looking at it and saying we have a little bit of a window still while Prince Fielder's, you know, still a good hitter. You know, we want to try and win with this core. And if we go into free agency this winter, being in Texas, being in a good hitting environment where people don't really want to go, and we have to go bid on Price or Cueto or Scott Kazmir or some of these guys, we're going to have to pay a lot more than 3 years. I mean, we're not getting any of those pitchers, maybe Kazmir, but certainly not the top line guys, right, for a 3-year deal. You're going to be looking at 6 or 7 years. They didn't want to do that kind of long-term commitment. And I think really the kicker for them is how much money they were able to get back from Philadelphia. I mean, we looked at it originally and said, hey, look, we think Hamels has less trade value than Phillies fans do because he's due essentially $75 million over the next 3 years when you include the buyout of the fourth year, or like $90 million over 4. It's a good price, but it's not a huge bargain. With the Rangers getting $9.5 million from the Phillies this year and getting rid of Matt Harrison's contract, they paid Hamels down to $42 million over the next 3 years. The kind of guy you can sign for $342 is a fraction of Cole Hamels in free agency. So from the Rangers' perspective, they're getting a huge discount on what Cole Hamels is. They paid for it in prospects, but I think when you look at the risk of the prospects they gave up and the fact that none of these guys were going to be ready to help the Phillies or the Rangers in a year or two, probably makes this a risk worth taking for Texas, even though they're not contending this year.
Moving, still in the AL, but to the AL East, a team that did kind of take some risks, the Toronto Blue Jays. They traded earlier in the week, this past week, for Troy Tulowitzki. They also nabbed pretty close to the trade deadline starting pitcher David Price for 3 prospects, most notably probably Daniel Norris. If not for his performance, then his...
Living in a van.
Right, for living in a van, exactly. Yeah. And they also pick up Ben Revere and I believe reliever Mark Lowe.
And LaTroy Hawkins.
LaTroy Hawkins as well, right, who should not be dismissed because even given his age, he is still producing. The Blue Jays are, they're certainly, you know, they have some ground to make up. Do you think they didn't, I mean, if you're going to make an all-in move, you really got to go all-in this year. Do you think they did, I mean, it sounds crazy, but do you think they did enough to contend by the end of this season?
Yeah, I mean, so I think I go back and forth on the Blue Jays moves. Like last week, especially since the Tulowitzki deal went first, I think that was a good trade for Toronto. I don't think they gave up that much to get one of the best players in baseball. Certainly it depends on Tulowitzki's health, but I think when you look at, you know, being able to dump the Reyes contract in the process, So they're essentially adding $50 million in salary over the next 5 years to take on Tulowitzki's deal. You know, that's not much. Like, just like with the Rangers and Cole Hamels, they're getting a significant discount on the price they're paying in terms of salary. So, that, you know, they had to give up some talent. But, you know, Jeff Hoffman's coming off Tommy John surgery, and, you know, the lower-level guys are pretty far away and might not ever develop into anything. So I really liked the Tulowitzki deal from the Blue Jays' perspective. But I think the more I look at this roster and the price they paid for David Price, which was very high, as Jeff Sullivan wrote last week, they probably gave up more to get half a season of Price than the Tigers gave up a year ago to get a year and a half of Price. Right. Yeah, I think as I look at it and say they're probably going to the wild card game, making up the six-game gap in the AL East is going to be difficult. They shouldn't count on, you know, winning the division. They have a chance to do it, but it's probably not going to happen. So they probably paid a really steep price to get David Price on the mound in a one-game elimination, which sounds really great. You say, hey, you know, I'll take my chances with David Price, you know, pitching me out of that wild card game. But then, you know, if you advance past that game, which is, that's not the goal necessarily, is to make the division series.
Right.
Now you only have David Price starting one game in the first round. And, you know, you have a lineup that with Tulowitzki leans very heavily to the right side. So I'm actually working on a post as we speak that will probably be up before the podcast, but maybe tomorrow. Anyway, at some point in the near future, I'll have a post on the Blue Jays' right-handedness. And the more I look at this lineup, the more this plan kind of reminds me a little bit of what A.J. Preller tried to do in San Diego before the season, where he just said, I'm just going to get a whole bunch of really good right-handed hitters, and who cares about kind of lineup balance, and who cares about matchups, and who cares about defense. The Blue Jays have a better defense than the Padres do, certainly. But when you have seven right-handed hitters and two left-handed hitters, which is what the Blue Jays have now, and one of those two left-handed hitters is Ben Revere,
right.
You're not exactly going to threaten your opposing managers. So you get into the postseason, you burn David Price in the wild card game, potentially. So now you're going into the American League Division Series with a lineup of seven righties and, you know, two lefties, the best of whom is Justin Smoke or Chris Colabello. I think your chances of seeing left-handed pitching in the postseason is almost zero. Like, unless they face the Astros, who happen to have Dallas Keuchel and Scott Kazmir, nothing the Astros can do about it. That's a bad matchup for Houston. But if you run into any other team in the division series, you're just going to get a series of right-handed pitchers. And I think the platoon advantages could end up being a big problem for Toronto, especially if they just face an endless supply of sinker slider right-handers. And, you know, they have to have Batista and Encarnacion and Donaldson and all these guys going up against pitchers who are specifically designed to get them out. I think the Blue Jays offense could underperform in October, and their pitching staff still isn't that good. Price helps, but he's not going to turn a below-average pitching staff into an above-average one by himself.
You mentioned a possible matchup for Toronto in the playoffs in the form of the Houston Astros. Well, I guess before we talk about their move, we should talk about the Mets, their move and their not-so-move that happened late last week. So originally, the Mets were going to get Carlos Gomez for a package that included Zach Wheeler and can't remember
Wilmer
his name
Flores.
Right now. Wilmer Flores, yes.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was that whole thing about Wilmer Flores crying on the field after some fans told him that he'd been traded. That deal ends up getting nixed. The Astros swoop in and pay much more than what I don't know. It seems like much more than what the Mets are offering to land Carlos Gomez. And the Mets look like they weren't going to end up, you know, upgrading a pretty anemic batting order. And then at the kind of the very end of the trade deadline, they end up getting Yoenis Cespedes from the Tigers, and don't have to give up Zach Wheeler. So and now, you know, the Mets, they had a pretty important series against the Nationals this weekend. You know, they're in a kind of a virtual tie for first, or very close to first. Yep, exactly, virtual tie for first. You know, their pitching staff is obviously very formidable. Cespedes is a good hitter. Is this enough for them? I mean, are they, you know, they've been on a pretty serious drought for some time. Is this enough, you think, for Mets fans to have at least some modicum of playoff hopes?
Yeah. I mean, so I like both the deal that didn't fall down or didn't go down and the deal that they did make. I think both moves were, you know, probably worth making. I think I like Carlos Gomez a lot more than I like Yoenis Cespedes, especially because he's under contract for next year at $9 million. So
right.
The Gomez would have been you know, not just a 2015 upgrade, but a 2016 upgrade, which is why they were willing to include Zach Wheeler. And I think when we look at the Astros price, we have to include the fact that the Astros also got Mike Fiers in that deal. So it wasn't just for Gomez. They got a, you know, quality starting pitcher back under years of control for basically no money. So the Astros paid for more and gave up more in order to get more. But I think when you look at it and say Gomez was probably a better fit for the Mets because Juan Lagares looks like he probably belongs on the disabled list or maybe in a part-time role. He's got an elbow problem that, you know, doesn't seem to be healing and he can't hit, you know, at a acceptable level or, you know, the kind of level that you want from a starting player on a playoff team. Cespedes is not a center fielder by trade. And they don't really have anyone else on the roster who can replace Lagares either. So Gomez would have been a better fit in terms of their roster. But at the same time, you know, if they weren't willing to take the chances on Gomez's medicals, and, you know, I'm not going to be one to question a medical staff. We don't have any knowledge in this area. It's just not our area of expertise. So I'll defer to medical people whenever they say that this is not something they wanted to do. Cespedes is still a good player, and you need good players even if it's not an ideal fit. And I think, you know, when you look at what they gave up, I don't think they gave up that much more than the Orioles gave up for Gerardo Parra, who's not Yoenis Cespedes. Right. And I think, you know, for the price they gave, to get a 3 or 4 win outfielder, even though you can't have him for next year and you can't make him a qualifying offer, and it's just a short-term rental, I think this is a move worth making for the Mets. I think I probably would have preferred Gomez for the Mets, just given their roster construction, but if that wasn't available, Cespedes isn't a bad plan B.
And so the Carlos Gomez and, like you said, Mike Fiers end up going to the Astros. The Astros find themselves somewhat inexplicably or surprisingly, I should say, atop the AL West. What was deemed a long term plan has accelerated perhaps a little bit, and General Manager Jeff Luhnow saw that and apparently decided to do some roster upgrades. You know, George Springer is going to be out for a while. They're saying maybe the beginning of September, but even that is looking maybe iffy according to some reports. So they upgrade their outfield, certainly, in Carlos Gomez, a guy who maybe isn't having the best season, but has a long track record of being a solid contributor. And they also get Mike Fiers, who will make his start sometime soon for the Astros. He will not be a reliever. He will be put in the start in a starting role. The Angels are close on the Astros' heels. The Angels certainly made some moves to upgrade their left field. They got 3 left fielders in the span of seemingly 30 minutes or so. Is this going to be, I mean, does this help tighten the race? I mean, the Astros, according to Fangraphs projections, it looks like they're projected to finish with a 90-72 record, 4 games better than the Angels. I mean, this is certainly not a push-in move, but it seems like a solid upgrade move for a team, even if they weren't expecting to contend this year.
Yeah, I really like what the Astros did. I think both with the Kazmir acquisition and the Carlos Gomez, Mike Fiers trade, the Astros made 2 moves that really helped them. I mean, you know, Kazmir obviously is a very good pitcher. Over the last couple of years, on a per inning basis, he's been as good as a guy like Cole Hamels. You know, certainly it's fewer innings and less track record and less durability, and you don't know that you're going to have him in October, given his long history of arm problems. But if Kazmir stays healthy, you've got a, you know, very good number 2 starter behind Dallas Keuchel now. That didn't come at a gigantic cost. And then you get a guy like Gomez, who's, you know, one of the best center fielders in baseball. You know, when Springer comes back, he'll essentially displace Jake Mariznick, who is a good fielder who can't hit.
Right.
So I think, you know, that in an ideal world where they have Springer in right and then some combination of Preston Tucker, Colby Rasmussen left, and you stick Gomez between them, that's now a very good outfield. And that's what their outfield can be next year as well. And obviously they're going to keep Fiers around next year as well. I think it'll be interesting to see how the Astros kind of look at their playoff rotation and say, you know, with Fiers kind of mixed in there with Scott Feldman and Lance McCullers behind Keuchel and Kazmir, they have a couple of options now where they can say, you know, maybe we want to maintain Lance McCullers' workload a little bit, and we don't necessarily want him to throw, you know, 200 and some odd innings this year. Mm-hmm. So he could potentially move to the bullpen. And, you know, they were certainly looking for relief upgrades. They didn't get a big arm at the deadline, but they could say, you know what, as good as McCullers has been in the rotation this year, we just don't know if he's going to be that good in October. So let's use him for an inning at a time, really kind of limit his workload a little bit and add a guy who throws, you know, in the mid-90s with a nasty breaking ball and make him our bullpen upgrade.
Yeah, and they also have Vince Velasquez, who just got sent down, but has also been used somewhat in a relief role. Yeah, Astros fans are excited about these moves. Moving on to the biggest trade, at least in terms of total players, a three-team deal with the Dodgers and the Braves and the Marlins, of course. The Dodgers get, as you mentioned, Alex Wood, and they also get Matt Latos and a bunch of other people. And basically, the Marlins end up with a salary dump, and the Braves get not only a competitive round pick, but or competitive balance pick, I should say. But they also get some interesting prospects. I guess I'll just say your thoughts, Dave Cameron, on the big three-team trade that happened.
Yeah, I mean, I think from the easy way to break it down is the Dodgers used their financial resources to essentially buy players that they wouldn't otherwise be able to get. So like Alex Wood, you know, that's not available in free agency. You can't just go sign 4 years of a pitcher of Alex Wood's caliber for what Alex Wood's going to make the next couple of years, which is like the league minimum and then three arbitration awards. I mean, that's just not available. So what they did instead is signed Hector Olivera to a $63 million contract and then traded him two months later, eating the $28 million signing bonus they just gave out like 60 days ago, and essentially used Olivera as a way to buy young, cost-controlled talent that they just couldn't buy in any other way. And so this is kind of the Dodgers being the Dodgers, saying, look, we have more money than anyone else. These financial restrictions don't really apply to us in the international market. We're just going to throw around a ton of money and sign everyone we think is any good, even if it doesn't fit our roster. I do think when they signed Olivera, they thought he would probably be their starting third baseman down the stretch, but Justin Turner's been so good, they just didn't need him anymore. So I think, essentially, from their perspective, this is a really rational, wise move. A lot of people were talking about them landing a David Price or a Johnny Cueto or one of the top line starters, and all along I've been arguing that they just didn't need a guy like that. When you have Clayton Kershaw and Zach Greinke at the top of your playoff rotation, you know, you're anyone else you acquire, even a guy like, you know, Johnny Cueto, might have been their number three starter in the postseason. And so in the first round, when you're only playing five games, your number three starts one time. And so do you really want to give up a premium package to get a guy who's going to throw six innings in the first round of the playoffs, and then you hope you advance beyond that and maybe gets to throw 12 the next series? But even then, this isn't a guy who's going to pitch super high number of innings, or this spot in the rotation isn't going to throw a super high number of innings. You're not going to be able to, you know, Madison Bumgarner this guy throughout the playoffs and give him 30% of your innings. So why pay the premium to get a guy like Price or Kazmir or Cueto, and instead maybe just go a little bit lower tier, get a guy like Alex Wood who's not as good, but, you know, not terrible, certainly an above average starting pitcher. And Matt Latos gives them depth, right? So now you've upgraded your three and four spots instead of just your three spot. Now you're not counting on Brad Anderson being healthy. If he is, great. Now you can pick between the guys, and maybe Wood goes to the bullpen where he becomes a very funky left-handed reliever. Or, you know, maybe Anderson isn't healthy in October like he always is not healthy in October. So this gives the Dodgers a good amount of depth and makes a lot of sense. And I think, you know, the most fascinating thing from their perspective is they got back Jose Peraza in the deal, who was the Braves' number one rated prospect headed into the season. Right. And, you know, probably doesn't have the highest upside as a guy who doesn't walk and doesn't have any power and might not have the arm for shortstop. But if you look at him and say, hey, look, you know, this is basically the same skill set as Ben Revere, right? Like, it's a very high contact, speed-oriented kind of player. Ben Revere has had an okay major league career and just returned a couple of prospects for the Phillies and has been traded for, you know, a couple of times. And so this is not a guy who has no value. And I think Peraza, to them, probably not that big of a downgrade from Hector Olivera long term. Like, Olivera is probably better, but not so substantially so that it also didn't make sense for them to get Matt Latos and Alex Wood and Jim Johnson in the same deal. From the Braves' perspective, I think they're kind of combining pieces that, you know, they were probably low on Wood and Peraza. Wood's got a very funky delivery, and his strikeout rate's declining, his velocity's declining. They could look at it and say, look, we're getting off this train before it crashes and burns, which it might very well may. And if they, you know, they saw Peraza as more of a utility player or a league average player, and they see Olivera as being an above average or maybe even an all-star, they looked at this as an opportunity to kind of turn a couple of maybe B pieces into one A piece or a couple of Cs into a B maybe. And the Marlins looked at it as an opportunity to save money.
Right. So there are two kind of tropes going on here. The one longstanding one that the Marlins are doing with, we'll call them cheap teams, I guess, for lack of a better word. Dumping salary basically in any chance they get, or spending early in the beginning of a season and then moving all those pieces in kind of money-saving deals. And then you have the Dodgers side who have very big pockets, or at least big pockets that they're willing to dig into to actually spend money on players. Do you see – so you got two sides of the spectrum here. Do you see any rules kind of being put in place in the next, I don't know, 5-10 years that will kind of counterbalance one of those, or is this going to be kind of the norm for a while?
Well, I think the problem is, like, I don't know how you stop the Dodgers from spending money, right? So, like, sure. Major League Baseball has passed a whole bunch of rules that tried to prevent this. You know, they put in place, more firm slotting in the draft, and then they put in kind of these recommended slots in the international side of things, which was really intended to drive down some of these bonuses and kind of get teams more in line with one another and kind of keep spending close in proximity from the top to the bottom. And then, you know, after about a year or two, the top teams realize that these penalties are silly and don't actually hurt them all that much, and they should just blow the recommended pools out of the water and take the hit for a couple of years and just go buy a whole bunch of talent all at once, which is what all these teams are doing now. So we're having essentially an exploit was found, and teams are taking advantage of it. And so I think anytime you pass any kind of new rule to stop a team with a lot of money from spending money, they're going to spend those resources to try and figure out how to get around your rule. And unless you are an amazing foreteller of the future and can find and close every loophole in advance, you're always going to be playing whack-a-mole. So you take a team like the Dodgers that has hundreds of millions of dollars in revenues, and basically, you know, Farhan Zaidi actually said in an interview over the weekend, they've never been given a budget. The Baseball Operations Department has never been told, you have to stay under this number. They can just spend as much as they want, and eventually the ownership might be like, hey, that's enough, knock it off. But they don't actually know where that line is, so they just keep spending money, and they keep basically having a blank check. I don't know how you legislate that away, because you can say, okay, fine, we're going to put in hard spending slots on international. They're going to find some other way to do it. They'll say, okay, fine, we can't go sign Hector Olivera anymore. Now we're going to, you know, eat the Ryan Howard contract in order to get some contracts from to get prospects from the Phillies. Or they'll go to, you know, the end of Miguel Cabrera's deal and say, hey, look, Tigers, we'll take all of Cabrera's deal and we'll just give you $100 million in cash, and we want J.D. Martinez or whatever. You know, they'll figure out ways to use their financial resources to buy talent, because that's what their incentive to do, and that's kind of the goal of baseball, is to take what you have and try and put the best team on the field. And I don't think we're ever going to be able to pass enough laws to or pass enough rules in order to stop them from being able to do it. So I think the goal shouldn't necessarily be to restrict spending from the top teams, but to kind of level the playing field as much as possible by shifting more revenue to the lower spending teams, and then forcing them to spend it. So don't let the Marlins just pocket the revenue sharing money, but come up with some way of tying revenue sharing to either expenses or some kind of system that allows teams to be rewarded for investing in their product at the low end.
Yeah, it almost seems like Major League Baseball, I mean, if you're going to get Jeffrey Loria out of Miami, they almost need like an LA Clippers situation where he just does something so terrible that they, you know, kind of kick him out of ownership and make him sell the team. But it seems like the Marlins are going to be, you know, scraping the bottom of the barrel and I don't know, hoping for magic to happen, angels in the outfield situation. So there are a few more moves that happened, maybe not all of them worth discussing. On air, the Cardinals got Brandon Moss. The Pirates added a few arms in Joaquin Soria, Jay Happ, and Joe Blanton. The Orioles, as you mentioned, got Gerardo Parra. The Cubs dealt for Tommy Hunter and Dan Heron, which seems poor Dan Heron just wants to retire, it seems, and he just keeps having to move. But maybe one of the bigger stories, or you know, at least as far as what we've talked about so far, is two teams that really didn't make any moves, those being the Padres and the Yankees. The Yankees are still in first place, I believe, or if not very close in the AL East. Nope, they're still at the top. And they are historically at least a team that if they are in contention, they end up making some kind of move in the midseason. And the Padres, of course, took on a lot of salary this offseason in acquiring James Shields, among others. Is there one team whose non-moves, I know the Yankees got Dustin Ackley, but is there one team whose non-moves surprise you more than the other?
Well, I think the Padres for sure. I mean, I would think the Yankees aren't done. You know, the Yankees have a history of making August transactions, and there actually is talent to be picked up this time of year, especially if you have the revenues the Yankees do and you can take on some dead money. And so I wouldn't be surprised at all if the Yankees ended up with Chase Utley in a couple of weeks. Utley obviously would be a significant upgrade over Steven Drew if he can prove to be healthy, and the Phillies would be happy to dump the rest of that contract and, you know, probably not demand much in the way of talent in return. You know, I think they'll probably also add a starting pitcher through the August trade waiver period. I wouldn't be terribly shocked if, you know, it's not going to be a guy like James Shields, but some kind of overpriced, high-paid starting pitcher is going to clear waivers. And if the Yankees look at Ivan Nova and Adam Warren and Luis Severino and look at these guys in the next few weeks and realize, hey, you know, we could really use one more starting pitcher for the postseason. CeCe Sabathia doesn't look like he's turning a corner. There's going to be arms for them to go get. So I wouldn't think the Yankees are not going to make any in-season upgrades. They didn't need to do it by July 31st because they can make August trades. But I think the Padres are certainly the team that everyone thought was going to do something and absolutely should have done something. And for whatever reason, A.J. Preller just has a very different definition of value than everyone else running baseball, except for maybe Dave Stewart. These might be the two guys in the very left-hand corner of, you know, on an island by themselves who just see things differently. And so, you know, he's certainly got his opinion of what a good return should have been. I think when you look at the Padres situation, I think we give them like 3% chance of making the playoffs. They should have at least moved Justin Upton. Like, I mean, I think that's the one that you can say is basically indefensible. When you look at what Yoenis Cespedes got from the Mets, I don't think the Mets paid an extremely high price. It's not like that was an outlier deal. But I think, you know, Upton and Cespedes are very similar players. Cespedes is having a little bit better year, but Upton has a better track record. I think the Padres could have said, hey, look, you know, if we can get one kind of mid-level, you know, back-end top 100 pitching prospect and a throw-in, which is basically what the Mets gave up to get Cespedes or something along that line, that's absolutely more valuable than a draft pick. And, you know, with a, you know, mid-30s or, you know, 25 to 35 range pick that they're going to get by making Upton the qualifying offer and letting him leave as a free agent, you're going to have a guy who's going to be, you know, a couple of years further away in development, who's not going to be able to help you short term, where a guy like Michael Fulmer, who Detroit got, could potentially be on their team next year. And so, you know, from the Padres' perspective of saying, hey, look, you know, we're not going to punt this sort of thing. We're not going to trade Shields and Craig Kimbrell and Tyson Ross and some of these, you know, guys who are under control for multiple years that other teams wanted because we really want to win next year when we're hosting the All-Star game. You should have gotten a prospect that can help you next year, or at least has the chance to help you next year. To settle for a draft pick, which is 2 to 3 years down the line before you see any return, is just not a good idea.
And it seems so counterintuitive to the way that AJ Preller behaved this offseason. It seemed that he couldn't make enough trades, and now, I mean, like you said, they have some assets that could have been moved for something, and it seems like they're comfortable standing pat and trying to make a push with their 2.9% playoff odds, at least according to popular website Fangraphs.com. It seems like so many opportunities were there to move and they didn't. Do you think, let's say, comes to fruition that the Padres miss the postseason, they have to move some of these players in the offseason next year, right?
Well, I don't know. I mean, this is the thing, is like, it's not clear what the Padres' plan really is, or if they even have one, to be honest. Like, it seems like their plan last winter was, don't be boring, make a splash, get the fans' attention, which they did. They made a whole bunch of bad moves that got a lot of national press and sold a whole bunch of season tickets, and those season ticket holders are not going to renew because they didn't like the product at all this year, and they put a bad team on the field. So next year, are they going to admit that they made a bunch of mistakes? Probably not. This is not necessarily what organizations do, is quickly you turn on plans after 12 months and say, you know, that we screwed up, we're going to go back into a rebuild, we shouldn't have ever done that. Most likely what they're going to try and do is just double down and say, hey, look, you know, we've got a declining and aging Matt Kemp, we've got a declining and aging James Shields, we've got a declining Craig Kimbrell, we've got, you know, Andrew Cashner for one more year. You know, we've got Tyson Ross for 2 more years. Mm-hmm. We're going to try and win with these guys. And so we're going to try and go fill some holes, and we're going to try and find a shortstop and a third baseman and a second baseman and, you know, all the other things they need. And I wouldn't be surprised if they ended up moving a guy like Cashner or Ross in order to try and kind of do a talent for talent swap and, you know, get a position player and then maybe try and sign a pitcher on the cheap and just say, hey, look, it's Petco. We can get pitchers to come here. And so I wouldn't be shocked if they made some moves this winter to kind of move pieces around. But the problem is that they don't need to rearrange the deck chairs. They just need more talent than they actually have. And now that they've strip mined their farm system, it doesn't seem so clear how they're going to, you know, go find 5 or 10 wins this winter. And so I think from the Padres' perspective, they're going to do stuff this year, this offseason. But I don't know if there's enough for them to do in order to be winners. I think that, you know, realistically, their offseason last winter put them in a really bad position to where they probably should rebuild, but they're hosting the All-Star game. The ownership doesn't want to rebuild. So if you don't have authority to tear it down and kind of say, okay, we screwed up, then you kind of have to push forward and kind of hope you get lucky. And I think this is basically what the Cincinnati Reds did this year. It was like, hey, we're hosting the All-Star game. We want to keep our guys. We want to try and win. We don't have a team that's good enough to do it, but we're going to try anyway. And I think the Reds saw, you know, that they basically wasted a season and wasted a decent amount of trade value from guys like Cueto and Aroldis Chapman and some of the guys they could have moved over the winter. That they, you know, they held on to Chapman. They got a decent return for Cueto, but they would have gotten more for him if they had traded him last winter. So I think, you know, you don't necessarily want to follow the Reds' path, but that's kind of what the Padres are headed towards.
And I think we'll probably end with this. I don't want to keep you too long. You certainly fulfilled your duties. As you kind of mentioned earlier with the Yankees, certainly the non-waiver trade deadline is over, but the waiver trade deadline, so to speak, is still in force. You know, teams can acquire players in a trade so long as those players, you know, clear waivers. Do you, besides, you know, who did you mention earlier? James Shields, who doesn't sound like he probably will move. Is there any other player that you can see moving somewhere? And other than the Yankees, is there any other team that you can see maybe trying to swing, let's say, a somewhat significant deal after the deadline?
Yeah, I mean, so I think the Yankees will be one team. I think the Cubs will probably be in on Chase Utley as well. I think those will be the two teams likely bidding on Utley. Maybe another team comes in, but I would think that those two teams will probably be the most interested in Utley. I think you'll probably see somebody go after Marlon Byrd, who decides they need an outfielder. Could still be the Royals, who I pegged him for in my deadline prediction thing. I think, you know, when they see Zobrist as a second baseman after Alex Gordon returns, they might realize, hey, we're still starting Alex Rios. That's not so great. And maybe they'll go get out Marlon Byrd from the Reds. Someone will trade for him. But I think maybe the more interesting question is whether the Red Sox maybe continue to try and do something with Pablo Sandoval or Hanley Ramirez, because these two guys will absolutely clear waivers, 100%, no question. If anyone claimed them on waivers, the Red Sox would throw a party and just let them have them. So both of these guys will clear waivers. And I think there were probably some discussions between the Red Sox and Padres that revolved around sending Sandoval to San Diego. The Padres need a left-handed hitter. They need a third baseman. They tried to sign Sandoval last winter. Obviously, they'd be buying low on him, and they might see this as one of these opportunities to get some talent without giving up much in return. And so if the Padres really are pushing in on 2016, you know, maybe they don't care about the fact that the end of Sandoval's deal isn't going to be great, but they might see him as a bounce-back guy for next year. Could there be kind of an interesting, you know, talent dump, salary dump between the Red Sox and Padres? Maybe. I mean, we've seen the Red Sox make a huge salary dump trade in August before with the Adrian Gonzalez, Josh Beckett, Carl Crawford trade to LA. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't be surprised if the Red Sox kept trying to do something like that this month. And if they moved one of Ramirez or Sandoval, it wouldn't shock me.
Excellent. Dave Cameron, we are approaching about 35 minutes, and I think that that you did a great job and that you fulfilled your duty. I hope I substituted for Sestouli in a somewhat reasonable manner. You haven't yelled at me yet, so I think I did an okay job.
Yeah, I mean, I would say the lack of Herb Alpert, the TM Ronna Brass, was a little off-putting. But besides that, you know,
we're putting that in post. That's coming later. Okay. It's a strict mandate for Sestouli that I put that in. So
okay, that will. Now, I would feel bad if this was a Herb Alpert-free podcast.
Exactly. All right. Well, thank you, Dave Cameron, for your time. Read all of Dave Cameron's things and read everything that's ever been posted at Fangraphs.com. Until next time, I am David Temple, and this has been Fangraphs Audio.